driving Dillingham to my car. I drive around it because work isn't very far. I call my phone and I check my messages, but I don't have any messages. All I know, driving on drugs feels better when they're prescription. All I know, the world looks beautiful, the world looks so damn beautiful. I feel fantastic, and I never felt as good as how I do.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to Tomfoolery. I am Ranjit Sowry.
And I'm Cody Melcher. How's it all going?
It's going great.
Yeah? You doing all right?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty well. I really enjoyed our book this time.
Yeah. It's good to go pulp every once in a while.
It is.
And for those of you listening who did not read the title, just because we always have to clarify for you people, the book we are reading is Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze.
Yeah, I think you have to imagine that with an echo effect every time you say it.
Doc Savage, the Man of Bronze. Was that better?
Yeah, that wasn't actually an echo. But I was trying to
do the announcer from the Super Friends.
Yeah, it was more of a reverb. It was pretty good.
Meanwhile.
Pretty good.
Cool. And that was written by Kenneth Robeson. Is it Robeson or Robson?
Robeson. That is his pseudonym. I don't remember the name of the actual guy.
I'm sure our guest knows. Let's go ahead and introduce our guest, Mr. Peter John Burns.
Hello.
Hi, Peter. How's it
going?
Hey,
Peter.
Good.
I like those glasses. It's
Thank
spiffy.
You. And by the way, yes, it was Lester Dent who is the
yes
the name how, behind Kenneth Robeson.
How did we know you would know this?
I remember Lester Dent because he described Doc Savage as a mix of Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan, somebody I'd never heard of before, and Abraham Lincoln, and said that he represented Christliness. I remember that.
That's right. Oh, Craig Kennedy, scientific.
Craig Kennedy, that's right, because I thought it was one of the Kennedys.
Right, right.
But it was not.
This is a famous 1930s figure.
Oh, well.
I believe.
Thank you, Peter.
The book was written in 1933.
Right.
So,
well, there you go.
And it should be said, Lester Dent didn't write all of the Doc Savage novels, but he wrote nearly all of them.
Okay.
180. There are 181 total, and he wrote like all but maybe like a dozen of them.
So, okay. So, what do you normally read?
It's not normally Doc Savage. Doc
Savage.
Sure? Yeah, Doc Savage was a legacy of my youth.
Okay.
I read a lot more nonfiction these days than I used to.
Such as?
Let's see. What do I have in the nightstand right now? What I have in the nightstand right now is Christopher Hitchens' The Missionary Position, about the takedown of Mother Teresa. I have Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States.
Oh, yeah, that's behind you.
Okay, and also on my nightstand right now, The Crimson Petal and the White, the sort of metafictional Victorian-era story about Sugar the prostitute.
All right, so nonfiction now, but fiction too? Or fiction in your past
fiction,
and maybe in your future?
Fiction has become a smaller part of the pie. I used to be almost exclusively fiction. And then, of course, you know, undergrad, graduate school, I read a lot of poetry. Not nearly so much and not so much contemporaneous. But I used to try to keep up. But trying to keep up with contemporary poets is like, you know, you have to commit. You know, you can't just dip in and there's so much lousy stuff out there. It's sort of like following baseball. You're either a person that knows who everyone is on the teams, on every team, and you watch SportsCenter religiously, and that's what you do, or you go to a game twice a year and have a hot dog.
Are those my only two options?
More or less, yeah. For baseball, anyway.
Peter has decreed, Cody. Yeah. Those are your options.
So now I have to go to two games a year?
Or you can go to none. That's okay. Your other option.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That was not stated.
I was concerned.
That was
not
one of the original options.
I've not fulfilled my quota this year at all.
So, Peter, do you have any favorite poets or fiction writers, either now or in the past?
Oh, sure. I mean, the never completed dissertation was on Byron and Dickens. Those are
love Byron.
Yeah.
And so Doc Savage was what you read when you were a kid.
Oh yeah, like we're talking fifth grade, sixth grade.
I mean, comic books or
novels? As the novels. I mean, it does have an interesting publication history because it started out as a magazine. You know, it was published monthly, which is why we all have to take our hat off to Lester Dent because he wrote a 50,000-word novel every month for...
It's like NaNoWriMo.
With
now that we're in November,
every
it's
month.
National Novel Writing Month, but
oh,
he just
it
kept
is.
Going.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
He did have to take a vacation at one point because he more or less had a nervous breakdown with the pace.
He was weak in constitution.
He started hearing like the characters talking to him even when he wasn't writing, and they said off for a little brief vacation for you, Sonny Boy.
Oh wow!
But yeah, so it was a magazine that ran for, you know, roughly a decade and a half, and then in the early 70s, Bantam Books brought them back out on a monthly schedule as paperbacks, and they were the sort of thing that you would have in the corner mom and pop pharmacy. And they had the big hook for them were these amazing covers, these painted covers. Mm. Doc Savage looked not quite human on them.
Wasn't the one, at least on the cover of Man of Bronze, isn't that the actor that played Flash Gordon? Am I correct in that?
No, it's not Buster Crabb. Neither is it the actor who played Doc Savage in the one movie they made in 75.
Yeah,
Ron Ely.
Ron Ely. Who was also TV's Tarzan and later on the MC for the Miss America pageant. He sort of took over after Bert Park.
You should have led with the Miss America pageant.
I apologize. The TV Tarzan series is one of those that rapidly disappeared from the public consciousness. Like, they just would prefer that didn't happen.
So, side note, I watched one of those episodes in prepping for this, and it was all in Spanish. It was dubbed in Spanish. No idea why I watched it. It didn't help.
Yeah.
It didn't help.
It could only have improved it. If you didn't understand what they were saying, you did better.
It is a nice credit to have at the end of your name, though. TV's Tarzan. Like, would like to have that.
That's
on
pretty
there.
Good.
Cody Melcher.
Or it's also a good TV's credit Tarzan. That you've watched an episode of TV's Tarzan in Spanish. So I think I'm ahead of you guys on that count.
Was it bueno?
I didn't really pay attention to it, honestly.
He had a young boy helper.
Yeah, that's right.
Kai. All right.
Who got in trouble, and then he would have to save him.
Yes.
So it was like that. So it was like Leave It to Beaver meets Batman and Robin.
No, sort of like a Lost in Space thing where like the kid took more and more time every episode. And of course, it was one of those misguided producer notions where they thought, oh, it's a kid's show. Kids want to see the kid, which is never the case. You want to see Tarzan.
Right.
No one identifies with Robin. You know, Robin is what you make your little brother play. Robin is not first pick.
I thought Robin was cute when I was growing up, but that's pretty much it. that's all I had. But yeah, you want to look at what like your ideal, like what you want to grow up to be.
Right.
Yeah, you don't want to be like, this is what I could be now, but I'm not. Like, if anything, it's more depressing to connect with the sidekick, because that's like what you're saying is they're not even the most important person in the show, and they're still having a better life than I am.
Right.
We're at the same age. Like, I need to get my shit together. What am I like doing? I'm sitting around watching television. I should be like,
that's not even a possibility
jungle
for you.
Person. Yeah.
Whereas Tarzan is like, maybe over the next 15 years,
I could get in a
plane
wreck.
I will develop into that person.
Yeah,
right. You know,
yeah. Maybe one day I'll get in a plane crash and be raised by apes, and then I'll be Tarzan. It can work out.
Though it's interesting thinking Doc Savage versus the other prototypes, that, you know, there seem to be sort of two strains in superhero-dom, if you will.
Mm.
Tarzan is one where, like Superman, it's impossible, right? By the time you're old enough to read Superman, you know that you weren't born on a distant planet, you weren't found on a rocket ship, you have no chance of being Superman. But Batman, before you learned that, like, it was all about economics and you had to be a billionaire, but Batman, you thought, oh, if I started running in the mornings, I could be, if I studied harder, I could be Batman.
Maybe there's a chance.
Right.
Yeah.
I've got a shot. You know, I don't have to find a radioactive spider. I don't have to be struck by lightning. All I have to do is work hard.
Well, I mean, especially even with the pulp guys, like that's the whole thing with the pulp guys. Like, I mean, seriously, most of those guys were just like, if I'm just hard nosed and gruff enough.
Right.
While also having good intuition. That's all I need.
Well, and weirdly, like, Doc Savage is a blend of those, right? Because on the one hand, his father trained him from birth to be this scientist, inventor, you know, superhuman strength, knows a dozen languages, has a photographic memory. I mean, they pull out another. He's a musician. You find that in a later novel that he also, you know, is a very good musician. He can do everything. But he also spends 2 hours a day working out. even as a grown-up. So the idea is like, well, he had a head start thanks to his dad.
Right.
But I could catch up if I, you know, if I applied my, rate to him, and if I were, you know, if I read up on languages, because of course it's one of those things where like, as he's exercising as part of his 2-hour daily regimen, he's doing calculus in his head. That's another...
Which is what you do.
Right, of course, because right. You have to, you know, strong mind, strong body, and all the rest of it.
Very American.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah. A very American story. Yeah. And again, there's this sort of interesting blend. I mean, it is one of the things that I find really interesting about Doc Savage is that you can see, you know, I'm assuming that you guys saw this as well. I mean, you go back and you read The Man of Bronze and you say, oh, this is where all the guys who wrote comic books 6 years later got their ideas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. He has a fortress of solitude. I mean, why they didn't, apparently, you know, they weren't copyright, you know, trademarking things then. But yeah, Doc Savage has this fortress of solitude. Oh, and then Superman gets one later.
Yeah.
He's got a group of sidekicks. He's very Batman-like in that he, you know, is super smart and rich, especially by the end of this first novel. He's got, you know, access to gold out the wazoo.
He's in New York City and he's got like a secret underground place where he keeps his planes.
That's right. He's got his own plane and his own submarine.
Where in New York City?
It's like under the Hudson.
It's off by the docks.
Oh yeah, because
by the docks.
And no one knows it exists except him. You know?
That's plausible.
Right, and he's got his team of people who all like sort of like a proto Justice League. Or a proto Justice Society, you know, have their own gig. But of course, since he's Superman, he can do all of their jobs better than they can. But he still likes to have people around for exposition. Apparently,
he breaks the idea behind what a superhero is supposed to be. Like, or not superhero, a character in a novel. Like, because you're not supposed to, in theory, have a character that is so basically flawless that it's just. Because you lose a lot of the stakes.
Right.
Like that's always been the problem with Superman. It's great in an American like USA USA aspect, but the idea that like unless you get kryptonite, you're fine. You know, like that's
right.
The only thing.
And eventually, kryptonite becomes something that an average street hoodlum has. It's the most prevalent, element aside from carbon on the planet at a certain point. But I think to some extent. This is a strain of literature that never gets valued, unfortunately, and I think unfairly, because these aren't books about characterization at all. You know, the three-line summary of each one of Doc Savage's helpers, you have Monk, the industrial chemist, and you've got Ham, who's the lawyer, and you have Rennie. He's a construction engineer, and Long Tom's the electrical engineer, and Little John William Harper, Johnny Little John is an archaeologist and geologist, and they all have like special talents.
And they're all like the best person in the world.
Absolutely. It's like he's gathering a trade union together or
right.
something.
Yeah. Except for him, of course.
but the idea is that like. All of those characterizations, I mean, I can tell you two other defining characteristics of each character, right? You know, Monk is short and he has bristly red hair and he has lots of scar tissue around his eyes. He is introduced that way in every book, right? And, you know, he never ages, develops a personal problem, a drinking habit, never has a relationship with anyone that extends past the end of the book. That's not the point. The point is these fantastic imaginative adventures they go on.
Yeah.
And that, you know, and that's really, I mean, an impressive achievement, especially in the pace that they were doing, that every month this guy could come up with a new plot where some fantastic device or gadgetry, you know, proto James Bond stuff. I mean, Doc Savage was into to gadgets long before, you know, Goldfinger.
He worked on gadgets even before he had a use for the specific gadgets.
That's right.
Right.
Like he would just try to invent things just in case they might be useful in the future.
Right.
You know?
Well, it was that beautiful part in American history where inventor was an actual job.
Yeah.
Oh, like, yeah.
Unless you were Nikola Tesla. Well, but then, and then he just got screwed.
Right. Well, but he still got to put that on his right. Like his tax return. I am an inventor.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, no one gets to say that now.
But like in that adventuring aspect, and not to throw ourselves directly into that maelstrom of this book, but it is that kind of Nordic, like old Viking Norse god thing of like traveling adventurer type of a thing. That idea of getting like the Warriors Three, this like group of like hardy people who are all like the best in their field, and they just go around like destroying titans. Like that's that very Nordic kind of haha.
I mean, I'll see your pretension and raise you. I think there's a direct line. I think there's a direct line from something like Jason and the Argonauts to this.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's sort of my point, which is that the point of Jason and the Argonauts was not to delve into the character of Jason, you know, and so too the Odyssey,
right?
And those works also use the same sort of tricks that the pulp novels use, you know, Phides Achates, you know, faithful Achates in the Aeneid, or the Wine Dark Sea. There are these tropes that you say over and over again, in part because, you know, for something like the Odyssey or the Aeneid, these were mostly oral works.
Right.
Joe and Frank Hardy, the Hardy Boys, right? You know, they're always described as, you know, Joe has dark hair and blonde, and Frank has blonde hair, and he's a little taller, and he's a year older. And you get that stock introduction of them at the beginning of every book.
Yeah.
Even knowing full well that if you are picking up number 27 in the Hardy Boys, you probably already know who Joe and Frank are. If you're reading Doc Savage, you're not saying, fancy that. I wonder who this Doc Savage is. I mean, but they'll always introduce him in a shorthand, and all of his men get the same abbreviated little shorthand.
Well, and then the other thing is the two or three characteristics of each guy are then referred to, you know, numerous times throughout the book.
That's right. That's,
and you know, because, to remind you.
You need to keep them clear in your head.
Yeah. Because it's the same thing. It's the Wine Dark Sea. It's faithful Achates. He's always faithful Achates because he's faithful. That's what he is. And you say that over and over because that's the mantra, right? These Doc Savage books are meant to be feats of imagination,
right?
Not of characterization.
So,
okay.
Since we're literary people.
Sure.
Can we talk about how this era of like pulp comes on the heels of what I would consider some of the most introspective literary periods, like Romanticism, Gothic era, and that kind of Jazz Age literature? Like it's coming right after all of those periods, and you went from like extreme introspection and like deep characterization to the complete opposite.
I just think they're different audiences.
I mean, even in America, you had Poe and all of that before you go into this era.
Yeah, but I mean, what you have with Poe, and existing at the same time as Poe, are another type of pulp-ish literature,
right?
That doesn't get reprinted hardly at all, except in a historical context, and those are all the terrible Western magazines.
Yeah.
Western stories, right?
Right.
So
But the popularization is different, though. Because those times, that's what was popular.
But the Jazz Age stuff was never that popular.
Oh, well, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you know, this is...
But the Gothic stuff was, to an extent. Not
terribly. Yeah.
But, like, the Gothic stuff was, and then you flip it. It's like more less from a writer's standpoint and more from an audience standpoint, there was a switch.
And yeah, I mean...
Did it have to do with the wars? Like...
I mean, I think to some degree it's a matter of there's an escapism that you're going to look for in the Great Depression.
Right.
Right. You know,
that's what I was saying.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's a lot of, you know, Nick and Nora Charles are rich. Doc Savage is rich. Yeah. We don't want to be reading about grungy realism in our popular culture.
Right.
Even the writer of this. I read a quote from him. Did you guys read that
quote?
Yeah,
he thought it was crap.
He's like, I'm just kind of writing crap every month to make a living, you know?
He made a good living, too, by the way. I mean, there's this image of, like, the Pope writer, you know, grinding these things out for, you know, mere pennies and dying in a garret. Lester Dent, like, owned a yacht. He got paid $750 a month for one of these things. Now, he had hardly much time to enjoy the yacht because he had another 50,000 word opus to crank out.
He could ride on the yacht.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But he did well.
Nice.
You know, $750 a month in 1933 is good money.
Yeah.
Well, it's yacht money.
It's yacht money. Right. You know, it's not, yeah, and let me be clear, you know, I mean, it's not 100-foot yacht money, but, you know, it's 30-foot yacht money. That's still some decent money.
Hey, are you guys interested in reading a little trailer that I've prepared?
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay.
Always.
So here's what I did. I went online and looked up the actual trailer for the movie.
Oh.
All right. And then I kind of did a rough transcription of it. I edited down a little bit, but everything that's in this script is true from the trailer, okay? So I did a little bit of editing.
Have either of you seen any parts of the movie?
Yeah, I watched a little bit of it while I was in San Francisco.
It's a fascinating example of how tone is so important with this sort of thing. Because in some respects, it is a very faithful adaptation of the book at hand, The Man of Bronze. But it's camp done horribly wrong.
Well, he also ran out of money.
Yes, George Pal, the producer. Yes. Yeah, he did. But it's just, they are trying to be so faithful to the book, and yet they're clearly condescending to it to such a degree, like, and it's not funny. That's the bottom line, is that, as opposed to, Adam West Batman, which is, you know, perhaps not your favorite take on Batman, but you have to admit,
right,
it's pretty goddamn funny.
It's an ethos.
Yeah.
Before we get started on the trailer, I just looked it up. $750, according to this, to the U.S. inflation calculator, $750 in 1933 is equivalent to $13,345 today.
Yeah, so he's making about $150,000 a year.
Yeah.
Cranking out Doc Savage stories.
That's pretty decent.
So well played.
It's pretty good. Cody, you'll be doing a lot of the voiceovers.
All right.
And playing the women in the story.
I'm going to assume there wasn't typecasting involved.
Peter, you are the star, okay?
Of course.
Yeah, the only way I can play Doc Savage is on the radio, that's for sure.
And, you're a charming man, sir.
And I will be doing, stage directions, basically.
Yeah, okay. All right.
All right. Also, one other note. The song that I'm going to sing later in the trailer is not the actual song from Doc Savage, the movie. However, it's pretty damn close.
Right. Well, all they did for the movie was they took John Philip Sousa's march and put lyrics on it.
Because they ran out of money. They ran out of money. Music.
Yes, exactly.
When slithering horror threatens.
A snake slithering.
When assassins narrow their sights.
Gunfire, gunfire.
When terrorists strike.
Somebody throwing a grenade.
When killers fill the sky.
Two planes having like a gunner fight.
When the green wigglies are coming to get ya.
Cut to a man lying on his bed and reading. A giant green glowing worm wriggles up onto his bed and begins devouring him as he screams.
When you're all doomed to die a horrible death.
Cut to a group of terrified people in the dark.
We're all doomed to die a horrible death.
When you're in that kind of trouble, who do you call on?
Cut to a montage of Doc Savage doing manly things, such as breaking through a door, leaping over a balcony, driving his car in a car chase, drop-kicking somebody. Throughout this montage, very manly Doc Savage song plays, being sung by a men's chorus. Doc Savage is on the way. Here I come to save the day.
Have no fear, Doc Savage is here.
Cut to incredibly slow two-person scene with lots of pauses between sentences. This is a two-person scene with Doc Savage and a woman.
Well, now you handled the documents.
Yes.
Is there anything you can remember? Anything at all that might help me find that land which was given to my father?
It's very strange. The deed was signed by the chief of the Quetzalcoatl tribe. But there is no something tribe. Can you believe this?
Yes. Yes. I think I can. My father got there. Somehow I must get there too.
Cuts a completely different two-person scene, also with dramatic pauses between sentences. This is Doc Savage and Princess Mona.
But it might take days to get there.
You've brought us this far.
I love you.
Mona, you're a brick.
And scene.
I, when reading the script before we began, did not think you were going to be literal about the actual Foley artistry, but all right. Also, side note on the VO, it should have said, when you're in that kind of trouble, on whom do you call? I just wanted
it
to make that
should have.
Clear.
They did not.
This was a faithful transcription.
We need to go back in time and fix that problem.
I did not put six.
It's a terrible movie. No, and it's one thing, for instance, to say, as they say in the book, that Doc Savage's muscles swell beneath his shirt as he tries to extract the bullet that the assassin has put into the wall, and it tears his shirt open. It's a far different thing to actually dramatize that, which makes no sense, because Ron Ely, the actor in the movie, is wearing a perfectly normal dress shirt. It's not tight at all. And suddenly he reaches to the wall and his shirt just tears open. And it, like, there's no indication that there's a reason for this, or that, like, there are muscles. I mean, it,
the reason
arm.
Is faith. Yeah. Being faithful.
He was Christly, and therefore his shirt rippeth upon his arm.
Yeah.
And lo, were there many.
And then it's just hanging
loaves.
There in shreds for the rest of the scene.
Also, I believe Abe Lincoln always had torn shirts.
He did.
Pretty sure.
That's why they used to call him Raging Abe Lincoln. Might I say, Peter, you played a valiant Doc Savage.
Thank you.
You are a good radio Doc Savage.
You've got it.
William Conrad was a great Marshall Dillon for Gunsmoke, and then they came to TV and said, oh, wait, you're the guy that's going to be canon one day. You look terrible. So I'm curious. I mean, as you guys have mentioned on previous shows, this is a show where one person makes the other two people read a book.
Or write a book.
Yeah, right.
That's our next podcast. We're going to force somebody to write a book.
They will be the real Tome Fool.
So what did you guys think of this, coming at it as grown men, not a fifth grader, with its breathless, many exclamation pointed style? Was it at all fun, or was it just, oh, Jesus, why?
I mean, I grew up on comic books, and I grew up on Golden Age comic books.
Okay.
So, like, I grew up on comic books of this era.
Right, which were directly inheriting instead of...
Yeah.
Indirectly inheriting.
Right. And, like, yeah, I mean, they had the thing where it was like, egads, my arm doesn't work. Like, that kind of... That's that era.
Sure.
So, I mean, this wasn't terribly out of left field. I mean, the reason why... Because we were in conversation about which book to do for Doc Savage. And the reason why I chose this one is because it had the most... indirect racism in it, and that part I enjoyed, and not traditionally. let's get that right on the podcast, right. So I'm not like, yay, racism, but it had a lot of interesting Mayan-ness.
Cody's a big fan.
A big racism. Fan of racism. I'm a huge fan of racism.
Actually, this podcast is. Like, every other book we read contains racism.
We dipped healthily into homophobia at one point.
We did.
So let's, we're not just about racism here.
Well, it's a weird, like, trying to be progressive racism in a weird way.
Yeah.
Because Doc Savage being, an upright, kind sort, and it should be said, ultimately, spoiler alert, he discovers that the map that his father was the land that his father was trying to find was the Valley of the Vanished, which is where there is this ancient group of Mayans, or this modern group of Mayans, I guess, by 1933 standards, living there, just sitting on top of an immense gold mine. And by the end of it, Doc's, the deal is all the gold that comes out, all the Mayan gold that comes out of the mine, was it like 20% goes to the government of this nation of Hidalgo. Like, two-thirds of it go to Doc Savage, and the rest is for, like, UNICEF, for the Mayans, locally. So, I mean, but
NGOs.
Right.
NGOs for the Mayans.
I mean, and there's never a thought, I think, either by a reader or by the writer, that maybe the Mayans would like the lion's share of this because it's their frickin' gold.
I kind of disagree with you there, Peter, because actually Doc himself says, like, when the king is telling him, here's what your dad and I agreed to, and the king says, and you're going to give one-third to us. Doc himself says, isn't one-third a little, like, slim.
Oh, really? I forgot.
Yeah, Doc says that.
Thank you.
And then the king is like, no, we don't really value the gold. Like, it doesn't do anything for us.
Oh.
It doesn't do much for us.
Okay, but from a collegiate academic standpoint, if we're viewing it from the writer prerogative, what you have there is you have, like, noble savage.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Noble white man.
We don't believe in the concept of private property.
Like,
we're beyond that
sort
of thing.
Oh, no, you're giving him an out. So it's like that they knew that there would be a problem in that he's taking all of the gold, but they still wanted him to take it, like the writer. And so then he decides, well, what's the best way to do it? Oh, well, the natives don't value property.
Right.
So then they'll just give it to him, and then that solves all the problems. But it's like, yeah, it's the white man's coming to save the day thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, essentially, it's just a big, goofy way, ultimately, to fund, you know, how does he get his own plane and his own jet boat? Well, because he
Mayan gold.
Right. He just telegraphs down to Hidalgo and another, you know, few donkey loads of Mayan gold comes out, and that's that.
That is that.
Can we quickly calculate how long a couple of donkey loads of Mayan gold would take to reach New York from Hidalgo?
Well, you order well in advance.
Oh, okay.
You know, he doesn't wait till the funds get, you know, he's checking the accounts and the investments, and when things start to dip a bit,
because they're going to get stopped at the border at least for a bit.
Sure,
there's got to be some
and,
sort of
you know, and like, you have to figure there's a certain amount of bribery charge on the way to New York.
Yeah,
but you know, those Mayans are tough too. So
true. Although going through the Carolinas, I'm sure there's going to be a bit of an issue there.
Oh, they'll just ship directly.
Oh, okay.
They're not going to go.
So you're
going
to put the donkeys on boats, and then the boats will take the donkeys to New York. Right. Okay.
Donkeys are also pretty good swimmers.
Especially when laden with gold.
I don't know whether you guys know, they train for 2 hours every day.
I didn't know
just
that.
Just in the art of swimming,
calculus. Do they also do calculus?
Calculus.
By the way, the Mayan strain, you know, the Mayan element in this book carries throughout the entire series. Because Doc and his associates, as you know, by the end of the book, they all speak pretty good Mayan.
Of course.
Right.
Who doesn't?
Because they picked it up because they're, you know, naturals at this sort of thing. So in all of the books, when Doc and his associates want to have a conversation in front of the bad guy who has him at gunpoint, they have it in Mayan. Because no one speaks Mayan except for that one valley of the Vanished. So they've got like a private secret language that only they know. And there's always some reference to, you know, again, there's like a two-line reference always to say, ah, yes, you know, the Mayan, the Doc Savage because of the Mayan golden.
I love that you can just like pick up Mayan, just, you know, hey, I learned Mayan while I was on vacation.
Yeah, it's a good thing. Oddly enough, there is no Rosetta Stone for Mayan.
Right.
Because God knows I've looked.
This is actually kind of like what Doc Savage does at the Fortress of Solitude, which is the, you know, it's this thing in the Arctic that no one else, I don't think in the world, knows about, right? I don't think even his five friends even know about it.
Just his biographer, the man who writes these books.
Well, and there, sorry.
I'm
going to get nerdy. Nerdy as nerdy can be.
Do it.
His Fortress of Solitude is eventually discovered by Johnny Sunlight, the only Doc Savage villain to appear in more than one book. and therefore is known as the arch enemy, the Professor Moriarty, though it's not clear that Lester Dent really, like, he's the only guy that shows up twice in 181 books, and therefore people have extrapolated, he's the arch enemy. Well, okay. I mean, he doesn't die at the end.
Point of inquiry.
Yes.
His name is Johnny Sunlight?
His name is Johnny Sunlight.
And he's the villain?
He is.
Point of inquiry. How is he the villain with the name Johnny Sunlight? That sounds like the name of like a guy who walks around with no shoes planting sunlight trees. Like,
maybe he's like the false prophet kind of deal.
He's very effete.
Why didn't we read that book?
Well, because to be quite fair, I read it so long ago that I'm not sure if he's like, if he's supposed to be effete or just a fancy pants.
Okay.
Meaning, like, I read it, I read it when I didn't know Charles Nelson Reilly or Paul Lynde were gay because I did not possess.
What?
Well, because, I've told this story before, but I mean, there was a point at which this was in the 90s, I was watching Burt Reynolds being interviewed on 2020, and he was telling a story about Charles Nelson Reilly, and he said, well, Charles, as you know, is rather
flamboyant.
And understand, my memories of Charles Nelson Reilly are him hosting it like on the Match Game.
Yes.
And he also hosted a kid's show called Uncle Croc's Block where he was dressed in an alligator outfit. So that's the last time I really thought about Charles Nelson Reilly from watching him on TV until 1993 when Burt Reynolds mentioned him on the air. And so I had this moment where I went, Charles Nelson Reilly is gay? Oh, wait a minute. Of course Charles Nelson Reilly is gay. He's so gay.
Yeah.
And like Paul Lynde. But, you know, there was no coding that, you know, C-O-D-I-N-G that, like, we were, like, you didn't pick it up on it, right?
Yeah, I guess it's different.
Lots
era.
Of old ladies it's watched Paul Lynde religiously every day in the Hollywood Squares and never had a clue because they didn't know, you know, that... That was
an option.
Well, no, yeah, that's what he was giving off. So I don't know.
Well, that's like the Halloween special. Have you ever seen the Paul Lynde Halloween special?
I just actually saw it with my children for the first time a couple of weeks ago.
It is fantastic. I highly recommend it to everybody listening. But when he plays the trucker, the glam trucker, with like he's wearing like a spandex trucker outfit, basically, with like fake chest hair and everything, and the whole time he's like trying to pick up this girl.
That would be. Roz Pinky Tuscadero Kelly.
Yes, Pinky Tuscadero. I forgot it was Pinky Tuscadero.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, and it's like you're watching it, and it is the biggest farce of a sham ever.
Right. Well, he did get to take home the outfits, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, well, of course. I'm pretty sure he brought them from home.
Yeah, that's probably true. But yeah, so I don't know if John, like, you know, they describe Johnny Sunlight as like when he dresses in purple.
Oh, God.
He dresses completely in purple. It's a purple suit and a purple ring, like an amethyst
on his
finger. Sounds
like the most interesting man alive. When I dress in purple,
yes.
I dress in purple.
So, but I'd have to go back and read it because I don't know if it was supposed to be coded for homosexual or, well, he just dresses
weird. Even if it wasn't, though, like let's give it the benefit of the doubt and be conservative about it. Even if it wasn't coded for homosexual, it was still that early American ideal of man versus you're not really a man.
It's still
a matter of effeminate. And that is still, I mean, that's still like an issue of like that heteronormative like masculinity.
Right. Well, I mean, again, there's another line I think you can draw between Doc Savage and James Bond. I mean, the gadgets are there and there's always something physically wrong about the villains. There's a weird strain in Ian Fleming that's very pulpy, which is that like you're a bad person because you have an extra digit on one hand, or you're a weird mix of ethnicities, you know,
right.
Like Dr. No, they're Chinese Negroes and that's suspicious, you know, and that really, that does come from this, you know, the Doc Savage where they had all of the, you know, he dresses strangely. There's something wrong here.
Right. It's an early 1900s othering, like what happened with communism later, where it's just kind of like, oh, they're all sneaky over there.
Well, and the other side of the coin in Doc Savage is when the men are complimenting to among themselves, they're complimenting these Mayans, and they're saying these people have clearly never mixed with any other races.
Yeah.
They're beautiful. These are pure Mayans.
I love a pure Mayan race.
Right.
That's good. They've got pure Mayan skull shape. It's nice. It's good.
Well, and the weird thing is, there's another weird thing, which is like the villains are usually like creepy and other.
Mm-hmm.
And Doc is, of course, this pinnacle of physical perfection. And all of his sidekicks are deformed in one way or another. I mean, Monk being the clear, you know, Monk who's the industrial chemist and sort of the comic relief, who's sort of like a proto-Wolverine because he's short and he's hairy and he's, you know, somewhat simian but incredibly strong. Rennie. He's the one with the giant fists that are as big as milk bottles.
Mm-hmm.
That's his, you know, Homeric illusion. And he's always smashing through doors with his giant fists.
Mm-hmm.
And then
there's like Johnny with the glasses.
Yeah. He's got the weird eye. And yeah, so there's a weird thing where like they're the deformed people that are on your side, but they're almost sort of like weird superpowers, right?
Right.
Like it's not that you're inferior because you dress funny or whatever, or you're other like that. It's that, you know, again, it's Jason and the Argonauts, right? You know,
yeah.
He's the one who can fly and he's the one who can see underground and he's
right.
the one
mm-hmm.
and he's the one with the big
fists.
Yeah,
and it's like deformities of like action or something. Like there's a thing, like a thing happened once, you know, that something might have happened.
Well, they're masked. I mean, they're
right.
They're things that allow you to do extra special things as opposed to you're weak and European and enervated. Because there's a very much a strain in the Doc Savage novels. I mean, it's again, yet another line you can draw down. Johnny Quest. Owes a lot to Doc Savage, all the way down to, you know, if there are three guys helping Dr. Quest that week, and one of them is swarthy, that's the guy that's going to betray you, right? I always like to think of Johnny Quest as like this like tragic tale of a liberal, because Dr. Benton Quest hires he has an affirmative action hire on every one of his expeditions. That guy always betrays him, and yet he will go and he will, you know, he's not going to be unbowed. Yeah. He's not going to be bowed by this.
He's not going to be racist. I'm not going to apply that just because it always happens to be that one person that they're all like this.
Oh, Dr. Quest. Yes. I will help you. No, you know, I like the cut of your jib, young man. You're coming with us.
Hey, are you guys up for a game?
Sure.
Game here. All right.
Yeah.
This is a game. I'm going to tell you the name of it, and I want you to try to guess what the game is.
Okay. All right?
The name of this game, you don't have any papers on this, is Mr. Roget's Neighborhood.
Okay.
Are we going to talk about some of the synonymic?
Yes, we are.
Well, somebody's ahead of the game. Yes, we are.
Okay. So here's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
I've picked various places in the book where there's a word used, and then within the next paragraph or same paragraph, there's like a synonym used for that word. Usually very awkwardly, like a synonym that doesn't really work, but
got it.
But for the sake of, he didn't want to use the same word twice.
Right. Okay. He's describing the blue sky again, so it'll be an azure expanse.
Yeah, exactly. So I got a couple of instances of these, and you guys are just going to kind of guess. All right. Okay. Take some guesses. So the first one involves the word red. So there's a page where he uses the word red, mm-hmm. and then within the next like three paragraphs, he uses four synonyms for red to describe all the same thing.
Okay. Right. Now, it should said that one of the characteristics of the villains in this is that they all have red-tipped fingers, which is why he's going... Yeah, yeah.
Did I miss that?
Yeah, the assassin... That's how you knew who the bad...
Oh, my God.
The bad... They weren't. They were another. They were a splinter tribe.
A warrior. Yeah. The warrior class.
Oh, right. Okay. And they all had red tipped fingers. That was their physical attribute that marked them as bad people.
So four synonyms for red, guys, that he used after that. I'll give you a clue about one of them, and you're just gonna guess. Take turns guessing.
Okay.
One of them is blank red, like beet red.
Okay.
But it's not beet red.
I'm pretty sure I know which one that one is.
Okay. Yeah, Cody, you can go first.
Is it blood red?
It is.
Yeah,
so that's one.
That's a good pull.
Three to go.
Is crimson involved?
I was thinking crimson as well.
Yeah. Crimson is one.
I'm going to guess scarlet.
You guys are right on it. All right. There's one more.
You can tell that Peter and I grew up on pulp stuff. those are pretty common. Fire? Red.
Fire engine?
No.
Fire engine's too modern. That's not.
No, I was thinking like fiery, like fire.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Like not magenta, is it?
No.
Okay.
Cinnamon?
No. Good guess, though. It's a pretty good guess. I'll tell you the first syllable.
Okay.
First syllable is V-E-R.
Oh, vermilion.
Vermilion. That's it.
Because vermilion also, you know, that's got multiple syllables in it.
Yeah.
That's
That was a deep cut. Yeah.
That was a deep cut. Okay.
Oh, man.
So here's another fun one. Whirlwind plane. He uses the term whirlwind plane, and then in the same paragraph, he calls it something, something. There's a synonym for whirlwind.
Is it P-L-A-I-N?
Oh, P-L-A-N-E.
Okay. Oh, whirlwind I was thinking plane. The other plane.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, whirlwind plane.
A helicopter?
Nope.
Is it a bird for the second for plane?
No.
Conveyance?
No. That's a very good guess, Peter. Conveyance.
Oh, man, okay. So we're going that? Okay.
You're gonna pull out the
dirigible.
Very good guess. That word is in the book, but that's not there.
Referring to the building, right?
No, it was when these guys were landing in the land of the
The Valley of the Vanished.
They were saying no dirigible could like stand these winds.
Yeah.
You know,
yes. Okay.
Whirly bird? No, that's a helicopter.
Ooh, whirly something.
Whirly. Is, oh, so whirlwind.
Whirly gig is the whirly first
gig.
Word.
Okay.
Whirly
oh my gig. God.
Whirly gig.
A contraption?
Nope.
Whirly gig blank. Wow. Okay. Yacht?
No.
Steamship. Ship.
Ship.
Whirly
it's a
gig
whirly
ship.
Gig ship.
Really?
Yeah.
For whirlwind plane, whirly gig ship.
That's right. And then I have
what?
One more. Okay. One more. This is a fun one.
All right.
The lackadaisical elevator operator later in the same paragraph is called the blank elevator blank. Synonym for lackadaisical, synonym for operator.
Lazy?
Nope.
Shiftless?
No.
I'm gonna go with that since it usually goes with lazy.
Yeah.
I feel like this is the most awkward game of password ever.
I know.
I might just tell you this one.
You might have to.
This is what happens.
Actually,
to you.
Let me give you the first syllable. First syllable is in, I-N.
I almost said
insouciant.
No.
Wow. Peter is breaking out the SAT words in this
I just,
one.
I grew up on a lot of pulps. If insouciant isn't in the
hey,
book, it's in the next one.
The game is called Mr. Roget's Neighborhood.
I know.
So.
Indifferent?
There you go.
Okay.
So the lackadaisical elevator operator becomes
indifferent
elevator.
Mechanic?
Nope.
Manhandler.
No. You're going to need a clue for this one,
okay,
too.
Okay, give us
okay
a clue.
The clue is, this is normally a word for someone who drives a car.
Driver?
Chauffeur.
No. Yes.
An elevator chauffeur.
The
yes.
indifferent.
As one does.
Yes, you must chauffeur. I hope he has a license for that.
He's indifferent about whether he has a license or not.
So he's an indifferent elevator chauffeur.
Yeah,
just so
that's
that we can...
right.
Okay.
That was just Mr. Roget's neighborhood, gentlemen.
I feel like... I am less impressed with the writing a whole book a month thing now.
Well, he was paid by the word.
Touché. All right.
There's nothing about the prose to recommend this book or any of them. They're all about plot, gadgetry,
yeah.
and goofy imagination. Like, you know, it's like you, again, I think part of the appeal to kids is like, did everyone do this? You were... in fourth grade, and you drew in your free time that they gave you the house you were going to live in. And here was the room that your comic book collection
yeah.
was, and here was the here is the underground river, and here is the secret passage. And
yep, secret passage.
Right, everybody.
I had a statue with a button. It was exactly like 1960s Batman.
Yeah, sure.
Statue button, open up the bookshelf, and then there's a pole, slide down under it, boom.
Right.
And you change outfits. I changed into a smoking jacket. You would go down the pole, and then once you got to the bottom, I was in a smoking
jacket. And there, you would just, yeah.
Yeah, and it was a giant library.
And there'd be Chopin. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
actually, that's kind of pretty similar to the place you actually live in.
But I mean, that's exactly what these books tap into is the notion of, you know, Doc Savage has a special radio transmitter hidden in a tooth, and that's the excitement. It's why you can also read one of these in an afternoon because there's nothing except for. You know, the occasional insouciant elevator chauffeur that will slow you down, right? I mean, and that's
but
just,
even that won't slow you down because you already saw what it
you
was
had it defined
earlier in the paragraph.
No, I mean, in yeah. a weird way, like it is sort of like a nice vocab builder for kids because
yeah.
you had the thing defined earlier. And you went, oh, therefore, this is a synonym for that, and that's a synonym for that. And that's
although I will say that if lackadaisical was what he started with and then he went to indifferent, I feel like he should have switched them.
Oh, sure.
It should have been like indifferent.
That would have been a better vocabulary.
And then lackadaisical elevator
chauffeur. It was the first book. He was just getting started. Just he cleaned that up later.
Well, I guess lackadaisical elevator chauffeur together sounds way overbearing. So if
right.
you split the two big words up, then you're like, you feel a little better about it.
by the way, this is actually a great lead into another game. I know we just finished a game, but
oh, no,
we're
going to
play
it.
This one.
Okay.
So Peter, if you can grab your second game thing and Cody too. Okay. This is
and
a game.
Follow along at home.
This is a game called That's What She Blanked. That's What She Blanked.
Okay.
Yes.
And what this is I went through the book and every time every synonym he uses for the word said So all of these, we're going to just read them one by one, and if you guys feel like commenting on any of them, do.
Oh, my God.
All of these
this is gonna take the next half hour.
Are words he uses as a synonym for said. So it's like, you know, blah, blah, blah. He blanked.
Murmured. He, yes. Yeah. Right, which, of course, is like the thing that every modern novelist will tell you to absolutely not ever, ever, ever do. That's like every time they do like a top 10 rules of writing,
right?
You know, Neil Gaiman's like, nope, you, this is the one
just
you don't do.
Said. Yeah. So you just said. Slide, because you slide past it. It's not important how.
Right. It's a comma.
I was about to say, I almost said he retorted earlier when you were doing blank, and then I looked up, that's number 44.
It is. It's on the list. It's on the list. So we're just going to read these one by one.
All right,
if you feel like commenting on any, do. You don't have to. All right, so
Peter?
Cody, you can start.
Oh, no, I'll start. Okay, admitted, number one, it's on page 29. I don't know if we're doing page numbers.
We don't have to do page numbers. Yeah. I put them there as proof for you guys.
Because
I didn't want you
to
think
back.
I was making any of these up.
You don't want us to call you a liar.
Yeah.
You're a lackadaisical elevator chauffeur.
Yeah.
sorry, agreed.
Asked.
Barked.
Breathed.
Called.
Chided.
Chimed in.
Good
chuckled.
One. Clipped.
That's wins in there a lot. Actually.
Clipped.
Clipped.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's pulp shorthand for short staccato. See
yeah.
here.
Yeah.
See.
He clipped. I clipped. Yeah. I don't understand. That's not even okay. I don't think that's actually a word.
By the way, many of these are on multiple pages. I
right.
just put one page.
You just put one so we wouldn't call you a liar.
Yes.
Commanded.
Concluded.
Concluded. Oh, that see that one right there. That's too much information in that word. Like you should have made your point that he was concluding in the actual sentence, and not have to say, by the way, he was finished.
At the same time, it's a little vocab lesson, maybe, for the kids reading it.
I
sure,
guess
right?
so. Yeah, if we're trying to sell these as SAT novels, then sure, I'm all concluded. For all of this.
They're understanding the structure of an argument, Cody.
this next one, I have the same issue with. Confided. That should have been apparent in the way he said it, not in actually having to write that he was confiding.
Well, he's over-determining. continued.
Decided.
Declared.
Directed.
Disclosed. Good vocab word.
Explained.
Floundered.
What? That is not even, that's not even the correct usage of that word.
Well, it doesn't stop him on several of these.
I want one of you to say a sentence right now in which you are floundering. Without quoting Mitt Romney. No? All right. I like the abba dabba dabba.
Grated.
Grinned? What? Okay, I'm out.
Several times as well.
Yes. You're right. That's a classic. That's to indicate irony for those who are a little slower on the uptake.
Oh, yeah, like this I don't know whether this was one of them, but when they're making fun of Monk, is Monk's the one who's not good looking, right?
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
They're making fun of him and said, "Ah, you're the winner of the beauty contest right now while I need your help." He grinned.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean I think that's part of the how to put it? I don't want to go so far as to say the prose strategy, but that's why you get elevator operator and elevator operator twice, because these are meant to be read at the same clip at which they were written.
Yes.
Mm.
And so anytime you can overdetermine something, that's fine, because this is being read on the bus, right?
Right.
Yes.
That makes sense, I guess.
Sorry, we are too groaned.
Growled.
Guessed? That, again, should just be inherent in...
Well, all of these should. I mean, gulped.
Yeah, gulped.
Inquired.
Interrupted. I like that one.
Lied.
Mumbled. Mumbled.
Wait. I like lied. That it's just like, I'm going to say something. I'm lying, right? Like, really? Okay. Murmured.
Muttered.
Nodded.
That's, again, not a way you speak. That's not an intonation of speech.
These are synonyms for the word said, as used in the book.
Offered.
Yeah. Pointed out.
Prompted.
Puffed? What?
Puffed, it was only once.
Right. But that's a sort of
as
puff, puff, puff.
Be.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Put the inquiry.
I'm out. I'm done.
Queried.
I dropped my paper because I was so thrown off by put the inquiry. Questioned.
Remarked.
Repeated.
Replied.
Retorted.
Said. Does appear many times.
Well, of course. You got to throw it in there every once in a while. Every dog
can we actually take a moment to to doff our hats to the fact that he not only had made it clear as though the question mark weren't clear enough that someone was asking a question, he came up with three synonyms. Put the inquiry, queried, and questioned.
That's pretty awesome.
That is some effort.
And weirdly, they come alphabetically in an alphabetical list of all the synonyms for Santa. Isn't that weird?
I am going to say this much. If I ever do write a book, every time someone asks a question, I'm going to end it with, put the inquiry. Because that is just brilliant. And
it's pretty smart.
I've never seen it. Where were we? Oh,
46. Said. Yeah.
Screamed.
Shouted.
Shrieked.
Shrilled.
Shuddered.
Again, not a form of speech.
Smiled.
Snapped.
Snarled.
Sneered.
Snorted.
Stuttered. Suggested.
Voiced? Really?
Voiced. Here, well, come the on. Next one's my favorite.
I love this.
Vouchsafed.
That's my favorite one in the whole book. Vouchsafed.
Absolutely. How could it not be?
Can you look in the book right now for that page?
The vouchsafed?
I want to see what sentence he vouchsafes.
I can. While I'm doing that, can one of you read the last one?
The last one would be whispered, which actually does make a little sense. I think that's like the one on the book, the list that I'm like, okay, I'm not angry about this.
All right, so here's the sentence with vouchsafed in it. This is in chapter one when they were all, the Doc and his men were meeting in his place.
Right.
And a shot came through the window.
Okay.
And they're figuring out where the shot came from.
If there's any lead up to it in the book, feel free to read that before we get to the actual sentence, if there's some sort of lead up.
There really isn't.
Okay.
There really isn't. Well,
I should have assumed in this book. Yes. Let's hear the sentence.
So here it is. The shot came from there, Doc vouchsafed.
Really? That's the sentence that required the word vouchsafed.
That is it.
He is a man of integrity.
That word only appears once.
Where did the shot come from? Put the inquiry.
That's another thing. There's a ton of places in this book. I had a lot of fun with this, where like something is said and then someone says it again, like the next paragraph. Or,
right.
Like, we kind of had that in Chesterton, especially with the balloon, where it was like, what? Oh, I say there's a balloon there. A balloon, you say? Yes, a balloon. How queer, a balloon flying in the sky, but there's a balloon over there.
Well, again, this is part of the overdetermination, which is these are, as you're rapidly whipping through the pages, you need the characters to mention things two or three times. You go, oh, wait, there's a balloon there. Because if you bury it in a sense, like with comic books, where, yes, there are the things up in yellow at the top of the panel that are actually supposed to be stage directions or giving you information.
Right.
But if you're relying on the reader to actually read those in order to get critical plot points, you are doomed.
Yes.
And if you bury the notion of a balloon in the middle of a paragraph in a Doc Savage novel, you're sunk. You need three people to say, hey, what's that balloon there? And then Rennie comes in and says, oh, I see a balloon there as well. Right, there's a balloon. Got it. We're on board.
But they needed to say it in different ways. So it would be like, there's a balloon there. And then he would go, ah, I see that helium inflated Lycra.
Right. I see that miniature dirigible over there.
The air-filled something.
Yes. Oh, that air-filled sack of floating above the
way. Thank you.
Yes.
Sack. I couldn't think of the word sack. That's how good my vocabulary is.
We've been drained.
Even after reading this book, my vocab sucks.
Well, I feel like we could go through it.
I was just curious, since you're always looking at politics from another era,
mm-hmm.
Did you pick up the sort of weird American fascism that sort of went through the book?
Oh, well, yeah.
I mean, Doc Savage, rehabilitates criminals by operating on their brains so that they won't be evil anymore.
Right.
Which is this adorable faith in science.
Well, I mean,
and also like the fact that he's a law unto himself. Like, he doesn't take them off to jail. He whisks them away to his medical facility. But again, in a sort of weird progressive state, which is like, no. It's not to punish these men. They don't mean to be evil.
Right.
I'll just operate on their brains against their will, and then they'll be fine.
Well, I mean, it's that whole kind of eugenics wasn't unpopular until the Nazis did it.
That's right.
But it's also that idea of that kind of, well, if people are sick in the head, then you just, like, drill a hole in it, and you're fine. Like, that's, you got to fix these problems. I mean, that's a whole thing in the back, in that back era of, like, homosexuality can be, cured.
Right.
Which is still a thing. But
no, but I mean, it is this sort of...
Yeah, it's that science over everything. It was that, like, but going back to Inventor being a thing.
Absolutely.
We were over fascinated with science, which would be nice these days still.
Right.
But yeah, that
it
idea
is part of the nostalgia, which is like, oh, wow, people actually thought that science could cure things.
Oh, that's insane. Right. Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, and that's actually replicated in almost the plot of every book,
mm-hmm.
because you know the standard Doc Savage plot is that everyone thinks that something supernatural is going on, right?
Like Scooby-Doo.
Yes, I mean there again. That's again what is so fascinating to me about these things is that, like, it's like all of the Doc Savage novels, like, were dissolved in the water of pop culture.
Yeah.
And no one really reads them. You know, I mean, they're currently out of print. I mean, we all had to go and
yeah.
you know, scare up this book through, you know, you just couldn't go to Amazon, didn't even have it as an ebook. They're gone.
Right.
For all intents and purposes. And yet, yeah, here's Scooby-Doo, here's Johnny Quest, here's James Bond, here's Batman, here's Superman. They all trace back to this source that no one pays any attention to. And they keep trying to revive it as a comic book.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because we've already got one of those. Right, we've already got a Batman, we've already got a Superman, we've already got
right, and more modern without it being like a weird throwback, and
right?
A weird, yeah,
but yeah, just about every Doc Savage plot is, I remember there was one called like the Evil Gnome where people were like spontaneously like their throats would suddenly spontaneously like burst open, right?
Or oh God,
yeah, I mean like it was really gory. Right? I
what?
Mean, like their throats were slit, but no one saw it. And it was, you know, was it a ghost or whatever? And it turned out that it was a gas that paralyzed you and gave you amnesia. So it wasn't that the guy's throat was spontaneously cut. It was that they sprayed the gas into the room and everybody was frozen. And they slit the guy's throat and then you all woke up and then he was bleeding. And that's all of them almost. Which
I'm
is
going to have horrible nightmares tonight.
Sorry.
Now. That
but,
was
but the idea is like it starts supernatural and then there is a rational if... advanced technologically explanation, a perfectly rational explanation for all of this. And that's Doc's purpose as he comes in
right.
with everyone saying, oh, there's a demon Sherlock out in
Holmes
the woods.
Yeah. It's the Hound of Baskervilles.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's that very strain of, and it is Scooby-Doo, right?
Yeah.
It's a guy, you know, no, it's another smuggling operation where they've decided to dress as ghosts.
Who knew that was such a popular thing? Right. Like,
there has never been a smuggling operation in the history of the world where someone said, hey, I'll dress up in this large owl costume and that will keep people, that'll keep the feds off the, no moonshiner ever did this.
I'm honestly, though, if we may, I'm surprised that no one, considering all the stupid burglars and like things like that, that nobody watched Scooby-Doo at the height of its time and thought that was a good idea.
Well,
I think there had to have been at least one person that was like, I never thought about dressing up like an Aztec mummy and then and then robbing a museum. I never thought about it.
I think it's that, you know, it's so much work. you've got to source the costume. You've got to get the projector that magically projects, a demon onto snow.
You've got to cite all your sources. You got to do all that background research.
The method acting you have to do.
You have to research local legends to figure out.
God.
Oh, they'd be scared of a large moth. Yes,
you got to nail the voice.
You got to wait until real estate prices go down, and then you can purchase the land in the area. It's terrible.
Yeah.
It requires a hell of a lot of timing,
right? As opposed to just a smash and grab or a carjacking.
I guess that makes sense. Yeah. But like a ghostly smash and grab, it was a demon. I don't know.
Right. Or a flash mob, right?
Yeah,
ghostly flash mob.
Oh, you could actually, a flash mob would be a great cover. I like how we're just giving like burglar advice now.
Well, the show is educational.
But the science thing. That's the funny thing that I always find about, not to get too political about it, but I mean, we're already in that area.
Sure.
That's the funny thing I always find about the religious right is that their idea of America is an America that existed like technically before America was really America, because they idealize the America of the early 1900s and a little bit of the 1950s, where we started kind of going away from that. But they really like that early 1900s America, but they reference the religion of like the 1700s America and then the 1950s America.
Right.
And the thing is that like the real America that we all claim to like, that whole bootstrappy Teddy Roosevelt style kids in coal mines America, was very science heavy. Very science heavy. Science overall.
What I do find interesting is that, like you said, you know, the eugenics didn't get a bad name till post World War II.
Right. Same thing with not to be indiscreet, hating Jewish people. Because I mean, a lot of people forget that FDR ran for his first few terms basically off of like anti-Jewish sentiment.
Sorry, you said not to be indiscreet. Are you actually a closet anti-Semite that
you're revealing
on the show?
Well, no, I was because I didn't want to say hating Jewish people. I felt like that was a tough. I'm being very liberal. It felt like a very harsh,
a tough thing to say.
Yeah.
No, I mean what I think is interesting is that the strains are there. I mean, you know, especially in that early 1930s period, there was a real sense of collapse of major institutions, and that's why. You know, you were looking at things like, you know, communism. You actually had an American Communism Party that had a lot of people, you know, because clearly the way things were working didn't work.
Yeah.
Right. Didn't work out. It collapsed. So that's why you do have people trying out fascism and trying out communism, because it was clear that the standard, you know, capitalist industrialist model just had blown up in the entire country's face. And Doc Savage, I mean, there is a strain of smiling fascism where all we need is one superhuman man, you know, one Ubermensch who will come and he will straighten it all out.
Yeah.
And, you know, and yeah, take the criminals away and he'll operate them on them until they're not
that
criminals
Hitler
anymore.
Cult of personality thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the idea of like, what America needs is a strong man. And I mean, I do think there's some of that, and that's why superheroes became a thing in that time.
Well, that was the whole FDR thing with him not wanting people to know that he was in a wheelchair.
And it's the whole FDR thing that there was going to be one man that was going to come in and straighten it all out.
Yeah.
And people look to FDR for that in the same way that, you know, you're looking into Doc Savage in a larger context.
Right.
So, you know, you're talking about like, why did it go from introspection to men of action? I think it's because, you know, the fucking country had basically flown apart.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've got people in bread lines. Yeah. Hey, guy who can fly? Yes.
Yeah, I want to read this little passage here.
Sure.
This is the scene where one of the Mayan red-fingered warriors was just trying to assassinate Doc Savage, and Doc Savage turns the table on him. The guy ends up being chased by a shark. He's, like, swimming in a lake.
Did he have shark repellent spray?
And he did not have shark repellent spray, and the shark is about to basically eat this guy who just tried to murder Doc Savage. Doc Savage goes in and saves the guy from the shark. Okay. And then here's what happens when he brings the guy back onto land. Doc tells the guys, "Free him." The swarthy breed nearly broke down with gratitude. Tears stood in his eyes. He blubbered profuse thanks, and before he would depart, he came close to Doc and murmured an earnest question. The others could not hear the breed's words. "What did he ask you?" Monk inquired after the breed had departed, with a strange new confidence in his walk. "Believe it or not," Doc smiled. "He wanted to know how one went about entering a monastery."
Oh my god. I knew it was going to be something Christian related.
A criminal warrior had just tried to murder him. He saved his life, thus convincing the guy to enter a monastery.
Just converting him.
That happens. That happens all the time. Oh, my God. I was really hoping he was going to vouchsafe.
he smiled. So yeah, smiled. Something.
At least he didn't grin, because then it would have been ironic, and then we would have been confused.
Yeah, but this was definitely a somber moment. Not.
He was smiling more wistfully than like a full-on grin.
Well, and it's also, you know, it's a matter of, here are the parameters of the time, right? I mean, I do have to give, in some strange way, the Doc Savage books a little bit of credit in that It's entirely patronizing to the other races, right?
Yes.
But he means yes. well. Right? I mean, it's easy to score cheap points against older popular entertainments because they're not as enlightened as we are.
And, right.
You know, I mean, to some extent, these books have the right to be of their time.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
And the weird thing is,
I have a Golden Age Green Lantern book where the cover is he's carrying a Mexican, like, who's wearing bandoleros and a giant sombrero. And it's right. just like, well, I mean, that's kind of how they drew them back then. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
How else would you know he was Mexican?
Right. And there is this weird strain in Doc Savage where, like it's like you were saying, they're the pure Mayans that, like, it is without a doubt established that because he's white and from America, like, of course he's better. Like, that's mm-hmm. That's not even a question.
Right.
But he is a benevolent sort to the other races, and they are allowed a certain modicum of dignity. It's hard. I mean, that's not to say that it isn't racist. It's just that it's a sort of, like, as progressive as one of those entertainments could be at the time. Right. You know, like, there isn't going to be any Pulp Fiction book where he's like, no, I believe two men should get married. I mean, that's just off the table.
Come on, this is 1930.
Right. But there is that aspect of that kind of, like, manifest destiny, white is right, that's still there.
Oh, yeah, it is.
So, yeah, I mean, like, but the problem is that in his quote-unquote goodness and, like, proactivity, it's still the same thing. It's just you've colored it differently.
Well, I mean, yeah, but my point is that, like, there wasn't going to be, by our standards,
right,
a non-racist entertainment of 1933.
I suppose.
Right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like you get, as do we, you know, no doubt my children will be going, really? Like, they'll be looking at Breaking Bad, looking at gender stereotypes and going, really, you guys believe that then?
Right.
Like, we thought this was cutting edge.
Oh, well, I mean, I already have that problem with Breaking Bad. Okay, there's no strong woman on that show.
Find your most progressive.
Right.
You know, without a doubt, the next generation will look at that. Just as, you know, you went and looked at, like, I don't know, Marcus Welby, N.D., where, like, he befriended the Negro. And, like, you know, in that, you know, or, like,
there were early Warner Brothers cartoons.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, even the ones that meant well. Like, there was a Superman comic where Lois Lane went into a strange contraption and became a Negress.
I remember that.
And then, like, she went to Superman. You know, she did, like, a whole, you know, black like me afternoon.
Yeah.
And then went up to Superman and said, would you still love me if I looked like this? And Superman actually went, hamana, hamana, hamana. And she went, aha. You know, and like, and
I remember that.
Yeah. And that story was so well meaning.
Right.
Right. There's not a doubt that whoever wrote that story voted for the most liberal candidate on the ticket in every election. And we look at it and go, holy shit. Like, that was the best you could do, dude? Like,
yeah.
And so, I mean, I do want to, like, rescue the books a little bit to say, a 1933 popular entertainment, you know, when you had, well, you know, you could go listen to Jack Benny or see, you know, an early Warner Brothers cartoon or go see Dumbo 7 years in the future, and they've got two black crows.
Yeah.
Right? Song of the South, hell, that's the 50s, right?
Oh, my God. I forgot about that.
20 years later.
Oh, I thought that was so much earlier.
I mean, I do have to give, like, yes, there's no doubt that Doc, the writer, the audience, all take it as an absolute given that Doc's better than the Mayans, and he deserves more of the gold, you know, even though they give him that out, because he's white.
Right.
But at the same time, like, it's like he tips well.
You know,
33%. Right. Yeah. But, I mean, and I do want to, like, because it's very easy to, like, go back and look at Tarzan novels and go, they're racist.
Right.
Well, yeah, no doubt.
Okay.
You know, yeah. Or even John Carter, because there's the green Martians and the red Martians and the white Martians. Well, we don't like the white Martians. I mean, like, yeah, absolutely. Just as, yeah, you know, Marcus Welby, you know, going to the ghetto and helping, you know, for one episode, and then he's back with white people. Don't worry about that. But, I mean, there's that sort of thing, too. I do want to say that, you know, you have to put them, you know, while recognizing that they're all racist.
Right.
It's too easy to say they're racist, because, yeah, no shit. And, you know, Paul Lind wasn't exactly striking a blow for, you know, the LGBT community
right.
on the Hollywood squares.
Right.
These things have to exist within the historical context.
All right. Touche, Mr. Burns.
Hey.
I'm saying this as, by the way, as the only white straight man in the room. So,
you know, yeah, you're at a spot many have found themselves in this room before.
Right. Just, yeah, but here I am going, Doc's not so bad. Come on. Lighten up, you two.
All right. Are you guys have the stomach for one more game?
Sure.
Sure.
Okay. So this has to do with the game is called Building Docs Sound. Building
okay.
Docs
okay.
Sound. So to just clue our listeners in who might not be aware of this, there's this weird thing in the book where Doc has this sound that he supposedly makes, like when it's his trilling. Guys are in trouble.
Yes.
Yeah.
By the way, so, that is dropped in later books.
Oh, okay. It's really weird.
Right.
I tried to think about it in practical sense.
Right. It's one really of the reasons weird. I think it got dropped. It was supposed to be this character, like when he got anxious.
Well, don't say more about it because you guys are going to build it.
Okay.
Okay. Oh, no. So, but here's the thing. Like whenever one of his guys gets in trouble and then he has to come rescue them, what he does is he kind of hides like nearby, his guys are in trouble, and then they think they're going to be killed. And then he makes this weird sound. It tells his guy that he's there and is going to save them.
Okay.
But it confuses whoever the bad guy is. They can't tell that it's him. They don't know what it is. So I'm going to read a little bit about it. You guys are going to build the voice characteristic by characteristic. Okay.
Okay.
So here's the passage from the book. Cody, you'll start.
Great.
And then a new sound was heard. It was a low. That's the first characteristic. Can you make this
sound?
So just like
a low sound.
Just a low sound, yeah. Okay, all right. It was a low. Okay, good. Okay. Now we'll have Peter. Okay. It was a low, mellow. That's pretty mellow. Okay. It was a low, mellow trilling sound, hold on, like the song of some strange bird of the jungle, or the sound of the wind filtering through a jungled forest. Trilling. Low, mellow, and trilling.
Those are almost contradictory phrases.
Sound like a bird or the wind.
Or the wind. Just give it your best.
I'm going to go with something more like a
oh, I like that one a lot better.
Okay.
I was trying to do the wind.
We're not quite done yet. Next sentence. It was melodious, though it had no tune.
Okay. So that would be, I'm going to go off of Peter's.
Okay. Peter,
yeah, that sounds a lot more like an actual noise that you would
make. Okay, so now we're adding.
Oh my god, it's more.
And it was inspiring.
Inspiring?
It was inspiring. So add some inspiringness to this, please.
All right.
Okay, to add inspiration, Cody started raising his hands. That doesn't really count because this is just a sound and this is radio.
You could feel it for two
reasons.
The voice
that didn't
because
really
of the movement. Okay. It's like in voice acting, you have to add body.
Peter, let's hear your efforts at adding inspiration.
It's very inspirational. That's I feel like it was hindered by the lack of arm raising, though.
Okay, and then one last thing. Okay, the amazing sound had the peculiar quality of seeming to come from everywhere in the room, rather than from a definite spot.
I feel like we just need to switch to stereo now. We have to do that.
Well, this
somehow
is the last one. It needs to seem to come from everywhere, please. Ooh, you guys pulled a Bobby McFerrin on me.
There we go.
Making two sounds. But
don't worry, be happy.
So yeah, I couldn't figure out what the deal was with that sound.
I have a theory about it that has nothing to back it up except bullshit, maybe.
So now we know what Peter did all through high school, was working on this.
No. I just actually, it just came to me as we've been discussing it.
A waking dream.
I think it may have been introduced in the earlier books because they were trying to do a radio show. Because this is the Street and Smith is the publisher. They also did The Shadow.
Yes.
Who started out as a radio character. Then they said, oh, he's very popular. We'll do a series of books around him. So there was that back and forth. And I do believe that there was a brief period where there was a Doc Savage radio show. I could be wrong.
Yes, no, I think there was.
Yeah. So my suspicion is that that was introduced as a note that, you know, that way it could be, you know, you can almost hear the rate, like, what's that noise? Oh, it seems to be coming from everywhere.
Yeah.
You know,
it's, and then, it's like that Green Hornet buzz at the beginning of the Green Hornet. Exactly. Where it's like, it's Doc Savage. Like, yeah, you get excited because it's like you can hear him there. Yeah. Like when
and,
the shadow.
And probably
shows
somewhat
up.
Described that way because they hadn't figured it out yet.
Yeah. They're so, like, there'll be a it's noise.
It's melodic and tuneless. It's loud and it's soft. Right. Basically, like, we don't know what it is yet. Just try and describe something that no matter
That's
what it
weird.
Is. Right. That no matter what it is, you just, go. Yeah, well, it's right there.
Yeah, just pick up distinct noise. That's the word, yeah.
But yeah, and I suspect that's why it was later dropped, because it's...
That makes sense.
Because it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, even in the early books, it's like, all the men are tied up, and Doc Savage, sneaking up on the bad guys, announces his presence by singing. I mean, it makes no sense strategically, and I think...
Makes all the sense. I don't know what you're talking about.
So, yeah, I think they just kind of dropped it, like, yeah. You know, like, the network came back and said, we're going to drop
I feel like that's going to bring us to the end of the show. Peter, do you have any other words of wisdom about this book?
I don't think so, except... Yeah? I mean... If you can put them back in context, they are fun, especially if you can find, like, if you've got a summer cabin, right? You know, if it's a cabin that your grandparents have and you take a sack of these out by the lake, you've got your 2 weeks of fishing covered, right? I mean, that's what they're ideal for. Like, you know, summer read, and it's a dusty box in your grandparents', you know, summer cottage up in Sheboygan.
And that's so if you'd forgotten that Peter was the only straight white male in the room, he just wanted to remind you with that little nugget of, if you take it up to your summer cabin in Sheboygan and read it while you're fishing.
To be clear, I did not have my family did not have a summer cabin in Sheboygan.
But it just sounds like a straight white male fantasy of, like, yes, let's go fishing while reading pulp novels in Sheboygan.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, I'm brown, and I would never, ever do that in a million years. But thanks for the tip, Peter. Yeah.
The television tells me that I would go clubbing if I had a summer off. So
got it.
So, yeah. All right, well, cool. Runjit, you got anything else?
No, I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
It was a fun read. You as long as you don't take it seriously, it's a fun read.
It's crap. It's crap, but crap on a bobsled, you know? Like,
that needs to be like the new advertising slogan.
Crap on a bobsled.
If they try to rebroadcast and brand and everything, they just need to put, like, crap on, it's crap, but it's crap on a bobsled.
Right.
Yeah.
On the marquee, that's one of the quotes.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my god. All right. Well, Peter, do you have any things you want to plug? Anything coming up?
Well, there is my podcast called This Week in Despair, which is a comedic look at the week's news that will be guaranteed to make you want to stab yourself by the time it's done.
That is true. I've been on that show.
Yes, you have. You were delightful.
Look up the episode. It's a good episode.
And I'm at the 2-hour comedy hour at the beginning of December.
Yes. And then we also co-produce and co-host a showcase up in Evanston.
That's
called
correct.
Double Shot Showcase with Chris Simmons, who was on 2 months ago.
Right. And that's every Thursday up in Evanston at 911 Foster Street in Evanston, if you want to stop by, 8 p.m.
Yes, fantastic. All right, well, Peter, thanks for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Peter. It was fun.
All right, and this has been Tome Foolery. Kiss your pulp novels goodnight before you tuck them into bed.
Take care. We'll see you next time.
To show how much I love you, darling, I would shoot the mayor. They'd lock me in a psycho ward, but I wouldn't care. I'd stroll into the courtroom in my straitjacket and tie. And when they put me on the stand, here's what I'd testify. I'd say, I'm crazy, crazy, crazy. I'm crazy, crazy, crazy. I'm crazy, crazy, crazy about you.